who continue to plan this way once they've gotten in the habit. The them is embedded naturally in their planning. But disciplining yourself to do it is a way to focus on keeping your students actively engaged. Technique 11. Draw the map. There's a final piece to effective planning that almost every teacher already uses. The problem is the teachers sometimes forget they're using it, or use it once per year and then forget to adapt and adjust it. That piece is the planning and controlling of the physical environment, which should support the specific lesson goals for the day rather than using the best approach to support the most lesson on average, or worse, to support ideological beliefs about what classrooms should look like. I refer to it as draw the map. Teachers in many classrooms seat their students in pods of desks that face each other because they believe that students should be socialized to interact in school. This is a general, in fact overgeneralized, belief about the nature and philosophy of schooling. With the exception of the fact that some teachers realign desks for tests, this classroom layout often doesn't change even if critical parts of the class period involve, say, taking notes on what the teacher writes on the board. This often erodes outcomes. Though students should interact in school, the time when they are supposed to be constructing a record of key information in writing may not really be the time for that. And with desks in pods, some percentage of students must now look over their shoulders to see the information they are accountable for, and then swivel to write it down in front of them. Furthermore, students now must ignore the student directly across from them to attend to the teacher behind their back. If the teacher's goal is to be attended to for much of the lesson, she has created a strong disincentive for that. The classroom layout has made the primary lesson objective harder to accomplish in deference to philosophy. What if, rather than asking whether students should interact in school or opining that they should, a teacher with this classroom layout asked, "When should students interact in school? How should students interact in school?" There are lots of ways, and it doesn't take much imagination to realize it's worthwhile to avoid conflating them. What should the way students sit signal and incentivize about the various kinds of interactions? Which kinds of interactions support which kinds of lesson objectives? What other kinds of ways can students be socialized to interact appropriately without necessarily building the classroom around that one idea every day? It might be that a teacher wants students facing each other only for some lessons. It might be that a teacher wants interaction for only part of the lesson. It might be that asking students to turn to one another and discuss an idea will suitably accomplish the goal at exactly the moments when interaction is warranted, without structuring the classroom so that some students always have their backs to the teacher. I'm giving my own biases about classroom layout away here, but you don't have to agree with me to use the technique. Draw the map means making space planning part of your lesson planning. I am, in fact, a big fan of rows as the default classroom structure, specifically three paired columns of rows, mostly because I see so many teachers I watch use it. This layout is tidy and orderly and socializes students to attend to the board and the teacher as their primary focus. It allows teachers to stand directly next to any student they want to or need to as they teach in order to check work or ensure being on task. It gives every student a place to write that is directly in line between them and what they are supposed to be writing about in most cases. Teachers who want them to interact more directly ask students to track the speaker, look at the person who's talking, or have them turn their chairs accordingly, or have them move their desks quickly to another formation. Regardless of the layout you use, where the aisles and alleys are is at least as important as where you put the desks. You have to be able to get anywhere in the room, preferably to within a foot of any student so you can whisper in his or her ear without leaning across anyone else, without a word, while you are teaching, in fact. Once you have to say excuse me to ask students to push in a chair or resituate backpacks in order to get where you want to go, you are essentially asking permission. You have to interrupt your lesson to be where you want. You have ceded control of and full natural access to parts of the room. This will limit your ability to hold students to high behavioral and academic standards. So no matter what layout you choose, think as intentionally about aisles and alleys as about desks. Finally, planning walls is important, too. The first rule of thumb for walls in the best classrooms is that they should help, not harm. This means that they should avoid clutter and overstimulation. A few critical things should be up, and they should not distract students' attention from the primary instructional space by being too close to it. Posted items are best when they focus on useful tools, reminders of key steps in adding fractions, examples of common themes, 7 types of conflict in a story, pictures representing recent vocabulary words, rules for bathroom use, phrase starters for agreeing or disagreeing with a peer during discussion. Once you've taught a key skill, posting a tool quickly after helps students review it and use it frequently. Though most teachers are frequently told to post student work, posting tools like this is at least as important. This doesn't mean you shouldn't also post student work. You should. But be sure to post work that is both exemplary and provides a model to other students. Often there's important work to be done in making this visible. Can you make comments on posted work specific and aligned to learning goals? Can you replace writing "great job" in the margin with "great job" starting your paragraph with a clear topic sentence? Or even "great topic sentence" clearly previews the key issue in the paragraph. If you can, it will help make success replicable to other students. Reflection and practice. The following activities should help you think about and practice the techniques in this chapter. 1. Choose an especially large learning standard from the state in which you teach. Try to guess before you analyze it how many objectives you'd need to truly master it. Now break it up into a series of manageable, measurable objectives that flow in a logical sequence from introduction of the idea to full mastery. Next, try to increase or decrease the number of days you have available by 20%. How does this change your objectives? 2. Make a building tour of your school, writing down the objectives. Score them as to whether they meet 4 M's criteria. Fix the ones you can, and then ask yourself where as a school you need to improve objective writing. 3. Think of a recent lesson you taught and write out all of the actions from a student's perspective, starting in each case with an action verb, listened to, and wrote, for example. If you feel daring, ask your students if they think your agenda is accurate. Even more daring is to ask your students to make a list of what they were doing during your class. 4. Make an action plan for your classroom setup. A. What should your default layout be? And what would the most common other layouts look like? Will you use them enough to justify having your students practice moving from one to another? B. What are the 5 most useful and important things you could put up on the walls to help students do their work? Are they up? C. What things are on your walls that don't need to be? Nominate 5 to take down. Chapter 3. Structuring and delivering your lessons. There's a consistent progression to the lessons of the champion teachers who informed this book. It's best described as I, we, you. As far as I know, Doug McCurry, founder of Amistad Academy Charter School, coined this phrase. Others use the terms direct instruction, guided practice, and independent practice to describe what McCurry means. This name refers to a lesson in which responsibility for knowing and being able to do is gradually released from teacher to student. It means beginning with I by delivering key information or modeling the process you want your students to learn as directly as possible, then walking your students through examples or applications. In the we step, you first ask for help from students at key moments and then gradually allow them to complete examples with less and less assistance on more and more of the task. Finally, in the you step, you provide students the opportunity to practice doing the work on their own, giving them multiple opportunities to practice. Put another way, I, we, you is actually a 5-step process. Step 1. Lesson segment, I. Who's got the football? I do. Typical statement. The first step to adding fractions with unlike denominators is to make the denominators equal. Step 2. Lesson segment, we. Who's got the football? I do, you help. Typical statement. Okay, now let's try it. How did we say we were going to make our denominators equal, Martin? Step 3. We. Who's got the football? You do, I help. Okay, Camilla, you take us through this. What's the first thing I should do? Step 4, lesson segment, you. Who's got the football? You do. Typical statement. Now that we've solved this example, try one on your own. Step 5, lesson segment, you. Who's got the football? You do, and do, and do, and do. Typical statement. Great, we're starting to get this. There are 5 more in your packet. Take 6 minutes and see how many you can get exactly right. Go. Note that the shift from one step to the next happens as soon as, but not before, students are ready to succeed given the additional independence. It's not necessarily better to get to the we and the you as fast as you can. Getting there too soon will slow you down in the long run. The recipe may sound obvious to some, but it doesn't happen this way in many classrooms. Often students are released to independent work before they are ready to do so effectively. They are asked to solve a problem before they know how to do it on their own. They're asked to infer the best solution by inquiry when they have little hope of doing so in an effective and efficient way. In many cases, they independently and industriously practice doing a task the wrong way. They reflect on big questions before they know enough to do so productively. In other classrooms, by contrast, students get very good at watching their teacher demonstrate mastery without ever learning to do it on their own. There's lots of hard work going on, but it's all done by the grown-ups. The answer, of course, is not to choose between the poles of direct instruction and independent thinking, but to progress from one to the other. Staging that progression is tricky work, though, and the key factors in designing an effective I, we, you lesson are not only the manner and sequence in which the cognitive work is released to students, but also the rate at which the cognitive work is done. This last part requires you to check frequently for understanding, a topic discussed in this chapter at some length. I, we, you, an overview. I techniques. Technique 12, the hook. When necessary, use a short, engaging introduction to excite students about learning. Technique 13, name the steps. When possible, give students solution tools, specific steps by which to work or solve problems of the type you're presenting. This often involves breaking down a complex task into specific steps. Technique 14, board equals paper. Model for students how to track the information they need to retain from your lessons. Ensure that they have an exact copy of what they need. Technique 15, circulate. Move around the classroom to engage and hold students accountable. Additional thoughts about good I. Include both modeling, showing how to do something, and explanation, telling how to do something. Include student interaction even though you're driving. You can still ask questions and engage in dialogue with students during I. Anticipate. I knew I was becoming a teacher, champion teacher Kate Murray of Boston told me, when I started being able to know in advance what my kids would do wrong, what the common mistakes would be. I realized I could plan for that. I could tell them what was going to confuse them before they got there, so they would be alert to the danger. I could keep them from getting tripped up or at least help them to recognize when it started to happen. From then on, my planning process included a what-could-go-wrong conversation with myself, and I planned to pre-teach what I knew would be the pitfalls. I put that right into my lesson plans. Amen. We techniques. Technique 16. Break it down. One of the best ways to present material again is to respond to a lack of clear student understanding by breaking a problematic idea down into component parts. Technique 17. Ratio. The goal of we is to push more and more of the cognitive work out to students. Feigned ignorance. Did I get that right, you guys? Wait a minute, I can't remember what's next. And unbundling, breaking one question up into several, can be especially useful. Technique 18. Check for understanding. Used to determine when and whether students are ready for more responsibility and when they need material presented again. You techniques. Technique 19. At bats. Technique 20. Exit ticket. Technique 21. Take a stand. Some thoughts on effective you. Repetition matters. Students need to practice over and over. Some of them learn the skill for good the third time they do it right. Some of them learn it the 10th time. Very few of them learn it the first or second. Go until they can do it on their own. By the end of independent practice, students should be able to solve problems to the standard they'll be accountable for, entirely on their own. Use multiple variations and formats. Students should be able to solve questions in multiple formats and a significant number of plausible variations and variables. Grab opportunities for enrichment and differentiation. As some students demonstrate mastery faster than others, be sure to have bonus problems ready for them to push them to the next level. Technique 12. The hook. If you can introduce material in a way that inspires and excites and can get your students to take the first step willingly, then there is no content about which you cannot engender excitement, engagement, and deep learning among your students. The way in is with the hook. A short introductory moment that captures what's interesting and engaging about the material and puts it out front. It can be a brief story, a riddle, a picture of the thing you'll be discussing in class. It brings Gregor Mendel's pea plants to life and makes Newton's second law of motion seem like the most important thing in the world. The hook is not a plan to water down material. Rather, it prepares students to be brought up to the material. It's not a lesson-long dog and pony show, not an hour of circumventing Romeo and Juliet to make it contemporary, but the 5 minutes that will open the doors of Elizabethan drama. You may not need the hook for every lesson, and you shouldn't confuse length in time with effectiveness. A 10-second hook can suffice as well or better than a 3-minute hook. After watching dozens of teachers hook their students on every kind of content under the sun, I've broken the types of hooks into the following rough categories, with the understanding that there are almost assuredly 1,000 brilliant ideas for hook that don't fit any of the categories. Story. Tell a quick and engaging story that leads directly to the material. Bob Zimmerle introduces long division with a story about a group of kids staying home without their parents and babysitting for themselves. The long division sign is the house, and they huddle by the door as numbers approach and knock from the position of the divisor. The key moment, whether to open the door, turns on the rules of divisibility. Analogy. Offer an interesting and useful analogy that connects to students' lives. For example, as I recently observed a teacher do, compare single replacement bonds in chemistry to dancers choosing partners at the school dance. Prop. You can jazz up one of the other styles of prop with a good prop. A jacket like the one the main character in the story might have worn, or couldn't have worn. Who can tell me why? A globe and a flashlight to demonstrate the Earth's rotation. Media. A picture or a piece of music or video, very short, can enhance your hook when planned carefully to support and not distract from your objective. Or assume the role of someone from the book or from history. Use this cautiously as well. It too can be distracting, and you can easily get carried away and waste time if you're not disciplined. Status. Describe something great, great work by a student, the reasons that Shakespeare is so highly regarded. Or mention that today you'll begin reading the works of the author many believe is the greatest of his generation, or the greatest to write about war, or the greatest to write about love and relationships, or to write in the English language. Challenge. Give students a very difficult task and let them try to accomplish it. See if you can translate this line from Shakespeare into plain English. An example follows. If you can't think of anything especially clever, a good game of Pepper, Technique 24 in Chapter 4, is a great challenge and works perfectly. In fact, at several schools, teachers use Pepper as their default if a more distinctive hook can't be found. Here are two examples. On a recent September morning, Jamie Brillante asked her students who knew what a complete sentence was. All raised their hands. Great, she said, and gave them 5 words, asking them to take 2 minutes to make a sentence out of them, encouraging them to try to make the best sentence possible. As it turned out, the 5 words couldn't be made into a complete sentence. After a few minutes of wrestling with the brain teaser, Jamie asked them to figure out what's missing. The answer? A subject. The surprise of the unsolvable riddle hooked her students for the hour to come. When Bob Zimmerle teaches place value to his fifth graders, he weaves a story about a hypothetical friend of his named Desi through his lesson. The houses on the right side of Desi's house are named tenths, hundredths, and thousandths. Those on the left side are ones, tens, and hundreds. There's a story about Desi walking down the block to get to a burger joint and passing the different houses on Hundreds and Thousands Street, saying the names aloud as he goes. Before they know they're learning math, his students are rapt. Like these examples, a good hook typically has the following characteristics. It's short. It's the introduction, not the lesson, and it engages students in a few minutes. It yields. Once the ship is under sail, it quickly gives way to the teaching part of the lesson. It's energetic and optimistic. It dwells on what's great about Shakespeare, for example, not what's hard or daunting or difficult, unless that's what's great. A final thought on the hook. You don't need one for every lesson. Colleen Driggs likes to use the hook on the first lesson on a given topic, as she proceeds through the often three or four subsequent lessons with objectives that develop and advance understanding of the topic, she turns to another technique. This seems like an especially useful rule of thumb. Technique 13. Name the steps. Why is it that the best coaches often rise from the ranks of the almost or not so great athletes when the most gifted athletes rarely make the best coaches? Why is it that brilliant and sophisticated actors can't help others do something similar, and are so often at a loss to describe how they do what they do? Meanwhile, unheralded thespians manage to unlock world-class talent in others. One cause may be this. Superstars often don't have to pay meticulous attention to the what's next and how-to of each step. The very thing that makes them brilliant, an intuitive and lightning-quick understanding of how to handle a given problem on the stage or the court or the field, keeps the most talented from recognizing how the rest of us, for whom the intuition does not come quick as silver, learn. The rest of us, who cannot see at once and then do it ourselves, beginning to end, are more likely to take complex tasks and break them down into manageable steps. We move piecemeal toward mastery and need to remind ourselves over and over what step comes next. One of my soccer coaches had been an all-world superstar as a player. As coach, he'd stand on the sidelines and shout, "Defense, you guys, defense!" We were pretty aware that we were on defense, though, and also pretty aware we weren't playing it especially well. He coached by offering pointers. "Don't tackle there, Doug." When I started to play for another coach, I realized how a coach might also be a teacher. The other coach broke defense down into a series of steps. First, position yourself increasingly closer to your man as he gets closer to the player with the ball. Second, deny the ball if and only if you are certain you can intercept. Third, prevent your man from turning if he is facing away from the goal. Fourth, steer your man toward the sidelines if he has the ball and has turned. Fifth, tackle if you must. Sixth, otherwise keep position between him and the goal. He focused his coaching, before the game rather than during, on reminding us what step came next. If my man got the ball, he would gently remind me, "Don't let him turn." If I let him turn, I usually did, he would say, "Take him wide." If, as was often the case, I found myself unsuccessful, he would say, "If you must," a reminder that keeping my position between the player and the goal was more important than winning the ball. For years after I stopped playing for him, I'd recall his steps, "If you must," while I played. Once I asked the second coach how he thought to teach the way he did. His reply was revealing. "That's the only way I could learn it." If you are teaching in your area of skill and passion, you likely have more intuition, natural or learned, than your students do, and you can help them succeed by subdividing complex skills into component tasks and building knowledge up systematically. Champion teachers name the steps by habit. Knowing how to do this is perhaps their superstar intuition. They traffic in recipes, the five steps to combining sentences with the same subject, the four steps to regrouping, the six parts of a great literary response. Their students learn the steps, refer to the map they provide as they are developing competence, and then leave the steps behind when they are familiar enough with the recipe to forget they are following it. Perhaps they even add their own variations and flourishes. For most, this is the path to becoming a virtuoso. So keep in the back of your head the distinction between champion performers and champion teachers. Champion teachers help their students learn complex skills by breaking them down into manageable steps and often giving each step a name so that it can be easily recalled. This allows the process to take on a consistent, often story-like progression. There are not just five steps to combining sentences with the same subject, but the steps are named, given a catchy mnemonic to help students recall them in order, and posted in the classroom so they can be used and referred to over and over again. Here are four key components or sub-techniques that are often part of Name the Steps classrooms. 1. Identify the steps. Teaching the process makes complex skills transparent to students. For example, Kelly Reagan doesn't just teach students to round whole numbers to a given place value. She teaches them the five steps for rounding whole numbers to a given place value. 1. Underline the digit in the place you are rounding to. 2. Circle the digit to the right of the underlined digit. 3. If the circled digit is 4 or less, the underlined digit stays the same. If the circled digit is 5 or more, the underlined digit gets one more. 4. All of the digits to the left of the underlined digit stay the same. 5. All of the digits to the right of the underlined digit become zeros. Reagan calls the portion of the lesson where she introduces these steps her rules and tools. When she names the steps, she's careful about keeping to a limited number. The reason is that people have a hard time remembering more than 7 items in sequence. So having more than 7 steps is a recipe for confusion. If you have too many steps to remember them clearly and easily, it's the same as having none at all. Reagan is also intentional about maintaining economy of language in her steps. As she teaches rounding, she adds wrinkles and complexity, but the part she wants her students to remember is intentionally focused and crisp. A teacher who examines a process like the one for rounding carefully and puts them into sequential steps gives her students scaffolding. This scaffolding is powerful, and with it the students can attack any similar problem. It essentially gives them a map to refer to if they get stuck, especially if they have written the steps down in their notes, as Reagan requires. This means they'll also have the support they need to complete problems for homework, no matter where they are and when they do the work. Finally, having clear and concrete steps lets Reagan post them on the walls of her classroom as a reminder. This makes the walls functional, not just decorative and motivating. Some schools don't stop at identifying steps for specific skills. They figure out the steps implicit in broader practices and methods, such as what to do when you are stumped and can't solve a problem, or what to do when you are reading and don't understand a sentence. 2. Make them sticky. Once you've identified steps, name them, if possible. This is the first step to make them memorable and therefore stick in your students' minds. It's also a trick to go a step further in stickiness by creating a story or a mnemonic device around the names for your steps. A teacher who is trying to help her students master the skill of inferring the meaning of an unfamiliar word or phrase from context clues created these steps for her students. 1. Figure out the general context of the word. What does it seem to have to do with? Words about cooking? About sports? About money? About happy things? About sad things? 2. Look for an appositive, a restatement of the word's meaning somewhere in the sentence. 3. Spot relationship words. And, but, and because, tell how a word relates to other words. I tried to stand, but tumbled off the cart. But tells you tumbling is the opposite of standing. In order to make this more memorable to her class, so that it was as simple and easy for them to recall as possible, this teacher added a mnemonic. She simplified each step into one word and strung the first words together to make an acronym, explaining that each letter in CAR stands for one of the steps in solving a context clue question. C, context. A, apposition. R, relational words. Then, to make the idea of the car even stickier, she made up a catchphrase. To gather the clues, you've got to drive the car. She trained her students in a call and response, technique 23 in chapter 4, to remind them what to do. When she called out the first half of the sentence, they'd respond with the second half. Teacher, looks like we need some clues here, and to gather the clues, class? Students, You gotta drive the car. To add to the fun and make the steps more memorable, she used lots of catchy metaphors in class. When an unfamiliar word that she wanted students to infer the meaning of appeared in the text, she might say, "Who wants to drive?" or "I think I hear an engine running." In her rounding lesson, Reagan used an interesting variation on this. She recognized that the most important steps were remembering what to do if the circled digit is 4 or fewer, or 5 or more. So she wrote a song to make that step especially sticky. It's sung to the tune of Rawhide. Roundin', 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 keep those numbers roundin', keep those numbers roundin', roundin'. 5 or more, kick it up. 4 or less, stays the same. All the rest, go to 0, roundin'. Roundin', roundin', roundin'. For that extra touch of stickiness, Reagan occasionally gets out her cowboy hat when her fifth graders sing the song. After that, all she needs to do is point to it, and her kids remember what to do. 3. Build the steps. In designing lessons, it's essential to name steps and make them memorable. Equally as important is the understanding that designing the steps can be a key part of teaching, too. A memorable lesson can be to derive the rules with students from one or several example problems through structured inquiry. For example, in her first lesson on rounding, before she's talked to her students about what to do when a series of digits carry over in sequence, as they would in 9,998 rounded to the nearest 10, Reagan gives her students a challenge problem that becomes the basis of her next lesson, where she derives the steps for handling such problems. She didn't do this impromptu. The answer steps her students arrived at as the key to solving such problems were carefully planned in advance. 4. Use two stairways. Once students know the steps, classrooms can have two parallel conversations going at once. How to get an answer to the current problem and how to answer any problem like this. In other words, students can narrate the process or the problem and the teacher switches back and forth, as in this sequence from a lesson on multiplying fractions. Teacher, what's the next step, Paul? Process. Paul, multiply the numerators. Teacher, okay, what are the numerators? Problem. Paul, the numerators are 4 and 1. Teacher, so the numerator in our solution is going to be? Problem. Paul, it's going to be 4. Teacher, okay, good. So Sasha, what do we need to do next? Process. Sasha, we need to multiply the denominators. Teacher, and the denominator is? Problem. Sasha, the denominator should be 2. Teacher, so I'm done, right, Conrad? Process. Conrad, no, you have to reduce. Teacher, perfect. So what's our final answer? Problem. Conrad, the answer is 2. You can often take advantage of this dynamic by adjusting roles, sometimes asking students to focus on explaining the process while she does the math, sometimes asking them to do the math while reminding them of the process, and sometimes doing both. Sometimes you can ask one student to concentrate on one and one student to concentrate on the other. Sometimes you can solve a problem and ask students to explain what you're doing and why. Sometimes you'll make mistakes and ask them where you went wrong or what a better way to solve would have been. In short, teaching the steps makes the process legible and easily followed in a consistent way. Technique 14. Board equals paper. Students often have to learn how to be students as much as they need to learn content and skills. And the processes and practices of being a student also must be assimilated by modeling. This includes one of the most complex and critical aspects of being a student, learning to take notes and retain a record of one's knowledge. As a matter of habit, expecting students to make an exact replica in their notes of what you write on the board is the right starting point, hence the name of this technique, board equals paper. As students grow, they can begin learning to make intentional decisions about how to take notes and what to include, but that process should wait until they're totally reliable and automatic about getting what matters down right. And the best way to accomplish this goal is to start by making your overhead a mirror image of the graphic organizer you give to students to take notes on. As you fill in a blank, they fill in a blank. You fill out the projected worksheet on the board and say, "Make your paper look like mine." Gradually, students should progress in the amount of the note-taking they exercise discretion over, filling out longer and longer passages of their graphic organizers on their own, and finally taking notes on a separate sheet of paper as you write terms and definitions on the board, exactly as you wish students to copy them down. As you introduce the skill of note-taking, guide students through the process, telling them what to title their papers, when to skip a line, how to make subheadings and headings. When they can do this reliably, you can again gradually begin to divest yourself of responsibility for exact phrasing, and let students own even that. But know that it may take years before students are ready to own full responsibility for such a critical piece of the process. Technique 15. Circulate. Circulate is a technique for moving strategically around your room during all parts of your lesson. It's not only relevant to the I portion, but as it's critical to think about from the outset, I'll address it here. As a profession, we frequently talk about proximity, getting near students to stress accountability and eliminate behavioral problems. But teachers often expect proximity to magically work of its own accord. They know to move toward trouble, but aren't always as confident in knowing how to maximize its benefits and what to do when they get there if proximity by itself proves insufficient. And of course, there's a whole lot more to know about how you move around your classroom beyond just proximity. Break the plane. The plane of your classroom is the imaginary line that runs the length of the room, parallel to and about 5 feet in front of the board, usually about where the first student desks start. Many teachers are hesitant or slow to break the plane and move past this imaginary barrier and out among the desks and rows. It's important, however, to try to break the plane within the first 5 minutes of every class. You want to make it clear to students that you own the room, that it is normal for you to go anywhere you want in the classroom at any time. Furthermore, you want to break the plane before a behavioral correction requires you to. This will show that you move where you want as a product of your decisions about teaching rather than as a product of student behavior. If you don't do these things, you risk allowing the territory beyond the plane to become the property of your students. Just as important, when you move out into the classroom to establish proximity only when you need to address a behavioral situation, this action will be highly visible to all, and in essence you will be telling students that things aren't going well and they've got you off your game. It also calls heightened attention to what you do when you break the plane. This will make the subtlety necessary to corrections that don't interrupt instruction, for example via proximity, almost impossible. If instead you're constantly out and about, you'll be able to correct inconspicuously as you teach or go about what appears to be a normal routine. Full access required. Not only must you be able to break the plane, but you must have full access to the entire room. You must be able to simply and naturally stand next to any student in your room at any time, and be able to get anywhere in your room easily and simply without interrupting your teaching. This is the only way to own the room. If you can't, students will quickly establish a no-fly zone that they know to be safely insulated from your influence. If getting anywhere would require the shuffling and dragging aside of backpacks or the moving of multiple chairs, then ownership has already been ceded. If you have to say excuse me to get around chairs and packs and desks to reach the back corner, then you are asking permission of the students to stand in that space. This means they own it, not you. This is a price no teacher can pay. Keep your passageways wide and clear. Find a better place for backpacks than on the back of chairs. Seat your students in pairs so you can stand directly next to anyone at any time. Engage when you circulate. It's not enough to just stand there. You've got to work a room. If you're teaching actively, in the I or we portion of your lesson, make frequent verbal and nonverbal interventions. Hands subtly on Stephen's shoulders to remind him to sit up. Check your spelling to Pamela as you gaze at her notes. As you circulate. There's nothing more awkward than a teacher walking toward a student in hopes of extinguishing a behavior only to get there and realize that proximity alone hasn't worked. Normalizing quiet, private interactions as you circulate gives you space to respond when you get there, hopefully with some of the tools described in 100%, What to Do, and Strong Voice, Techniques 36 to 38 in Chapter 6. It's equally important to offer positive reinforcement as you circulate, again, either verbally or non-verbally. Thumbs up to Michael, I like it to Jasmine as you glance at her notes, and constructively. Finally, reading, assessing, and responding to student work as it is happening is indispensable to checking for understanding and sets a tone of accountability. Both are critical to your ability to provide academic support and rigor. Try that one again, Charles. Just right, Jamel. You haven't shown me the third step. Move systematically. Look for opportunities to circulate systematically, that is, universally and impersonally, but unpredictably. This not only exerts accountability pressure on all students, but allows you to exert pressure on the students who pose the greatest challenges for you without revealing to them that they pose a challenge. If you announce to your class, "I need everyone's eyes on me," and march directly toward Alphonse, your toughest kid, you are telling Alphonse that you are worried that he will not comply and you may not be able to control him. Alphonse may comply with that request, but inside he may be smiling, knowing that he has you rattled. Preemptively moving down each row, asking each student for his or her eyes in turn, and pausing briefly for them to meet your eyes, will ensure that you address Alphonse, but you won't make your anxiety about him visible. Of course, there will also be times when he is off task and you must move right toward him, but when you are making a proactive request, do your best to treat Alphonse like just another member of the class by moving systematically. Be aware, though, that systematic is not the same as predictable. If you always follow a predictable order of interactions as you circulate, students will know when you'll be likely to get to them and react accordingly. Avoid using the same pattern every time, left to right, clockwise around the room. Vary your pattern and skip interacting with some students, and invest heavily in time spent with others, unpredictably as you circulate. Position for power. As you circulate, your goal should be to remain facing as much of the class as possible. Then you can see what's going on around you at a glance and with minimal transaction cost. You can lift your eyes quickly from a student's paper and then return to reading in a fraction of a second. Turning your back, by contrast, invites opportunistic behavior. Think of yourself as the sun. It turns on two axes at the same time, both revolving, moving around the sun, and rotating, changing the way it faces. This may require you to consider what side of students you stand on as you circulate, and to lift a student's paper off his desk and subtly reorient yourself to face more of the class as you read. Second, leverage student blind spots. The most powerful position to be in with another person is one where you can see him, he knows you can see him, and he can't see you. Standing just over a student's shoulder as you peruse his work, or standing at the back of the classroom as a class discusses a topic, builds subtle but pervasive control of the classroom environment in order to focus it on learning. Technique 16. Break it down. Break it down is a critically important teaching tool, but it can be challenging to use because it is primarily a reactive strategy. You use it in response to a student error at the moment the incorrect answer happens. Most teachers recognize that when a student error occurs, simply repeating the original question is unlikely to be especially helpful unless you have reason to believe the student failed to hear you the first time. But what to do instead? As soon as they recognize an error or a guess, champion teachers conceptualize the original material as a series of smaller, simpler pieces. They then go back and ask a question or present information that bridges the part of the material that they think was most likely to have caused the error, thus building the student's knowledge back up from a point of partial understanding. Consider a simple example. A student in Darrell Williams's classroom, reading aloud, was unable to decode the word nature. He hesitatingly sounded na-na before falling silent. Williams responded by writing the word on the board and saying, "This is the word you're trying to read." He paused briefly and drew a short horizontal line, the sign of a long vowel, above the A. He paused again to see if the student recognized the meaning. He didn't, and Darrell proceeded to break it down one step further, saying, "Long A," as he pointed to the horizontal line. This intervention was effective. With new information on the problem spot, the vowel sound, the student was able to combine the new knowledge Williams provided with the knowledge he had of the other letter sounds. He now read the word correctly. Williams had successfully isolated the problem part within the larger error and caused the student to use his previous knowledge to arrive at a successful solution without Williams providing it. Williams might just have said, "That word is nature." This would have been faster, for sure, but it would have left the student with little or no cognitive work to do, and would have emphasized the failure rather than the success, both in terms of the student ultimately getting it right, and also in terms of his using some knowledge he did have to solve the problem. It's worthwhile to note at how many different levels even this question could be broken down, because determining the degree to which to break down a problem or question is a critical decision. You never know exactly how big the gap is between the student's level of knowledge and the knowledge necessary for mastery. But in most cases, you want to provide the smallest hint possible and still enable your student to get to the correct answer successfully. This will cause your student to apply what she knows to the greatest degree possible. It's worth thinking about some of the subtler ways that information can be broken down. For example, in the case of the student struggling to read the word nature, merely rewriting the word on the board, a very minimal hint, might have proven effective. Seeing the word in a new context, on the board where perhaps he'd seen it before, might have jogged his memory. Providing such a minimal hint gets at the tension in Break It Down, however. While one goal is to break things down to the least degree possible, another is to do it quickly, thus managing time and pace. Meticulously adding a thin additional slice of knowledge to each previous subtle hint would be the perfect solution to the goal of causing students to do the greatest amount of cognitive work, but would likely derail instruction in a series of tedious exercises and squander time that could be used more productively. Break It Down is a complex and challenging technique. One of the best ways to ensure success with it is to prepare for it as part of the lesson planning process, by identifying potential trouble spots and drafting both anticipated wrong answers and possible cues. Another solution is to use consistent types of follow-ups. These patterns are often highly successful and are a good starting point in thinking about how to cue, although there are probably a limitless number of ways to break down difficult information and tasks, these six offer a good starting point. Provide an example. If you got a blank stare when you asked for the definition of a prime number, you might say 7 is 1, or 7 is 1 and so is 11. If you want to break it down further, you could cue 7 is 1 but 8 is not. You could take it a step further by observing 8's factors include 2 and 4. At some point there's not much left to cue, and a technique like no opt-out, technique 1, who can tell David what a prime number is, might become more appropriate. You can also provide additional examples if the question stumping the student was originally based on categorizing an example of something. For example, a student in Jamie Brillante's fifth grade writing class struggled to identify the part of speech of the word owner. It's hard to provide an example of the word owner, so instead Brillante provided another, cueing, well, owner would logically be the same part of speech as other words that end in ER, dancer, swimmer, singer. What are those? She asked. They're people, the student replied. Jamie prompted, and people have to be, as the student chimed in, nouns. Provide context. Another student in Jamie Brillante's class was stumped when asked to name the part of speech of the word ancient. Brillante noted that it had been a vocabulary word in another teacher's class. The student remained stumped. I hope nobody ever calls me ancient, cued Brillante. Nothing. Maybe in, like, 2080 you could call me ancient, but that would be the only time it was acceptable. Oh, yeah, it's very old, the student successfully recalled. It's important to note that Brillante is using this approach with a vocabulary word she knows the student learned, but is having trouble remembering. This strategy would be far less effective if Brillante did not know whether the student knew anything at all about the word. To return to the definition of prime number, you might observe that positive integers are either prime or composite. Or you might refer to a previous conversation. We discussed prime and composite, and we spent some time on the example of the number 8. Or, you'll recall from our discussion last week that factors are important in deciding whether a number is prime. Provide a rule. In Christy Huelskamp's sixth grade reading class at Williamsburg Collegiate in Brooklyn, a student guessed incorrectly that indiscriminate was a verb when used in the sentence, James was an indiscriminate reader. He would pick up any book from the library and read it cover to cover. Huelskamp replied with a rule. A verb is an action or a state of being. Is indiscriminate describing an action? The student quickly recognized that it was modifying a noun. It's an adjective, she said. Provide the missing or first step. When a student in her fifth grade math class was unable to explain what was wrong with writing the number 15/16, Kelly Reagan cued, "Well, what do we always do when the numerator is larger than the denominator?" Instantly, the student caught on. "Oh, we need to make a mixed number, so I divide 6 into 15. Rollback. Sometimes it's sufficient to repeat a student's answer back to her. Many of us instantly recognize our errors when they're played back for us, as if on tape. If a student in Reagan's class had proposed reducing an improper fraction to a mixed number by multiplying the numerator and denominator, Kelly might merely repeat that back to her. "You said that I would multiply 6 times 15 to reduce." The degree of emphasis she places on the word multiply would be key in determining how much of the gap between answer and mastery Reagan was breaking down. Emphasis on multiply makes the hint much bigger. Regardless, hearing your own error in another's words is often revealing. Eliminate false choices. When Berlante's student struggled to recognize that owner was a noun, she could have eliminated some false choices as follows. "Well, let's go through some of the options. If it were a verb, it would be an action. Is owner an action? Can you or I owner? Well, what about an adjective? Is it telling me what kind or how many of some noun?" Technique 17. Ratio. One of our most important goals as teachers is to cause students to do as much of the cognitive work, the writing, the thinking, the analyzing, the talking, as possible. The proportion of the cognitive work students do in your classroom is known as your ratio. To my knowledge, the term was coined by David Levin, co-founder of the nationally known and high-achieving Knowledge is Power, KIPP for short, schools, and in many people's eyes, one of the country's most insightful and effective teachers. As you embrace ratio, you'll find yourself rarely completing a problem at the board without the input of your students. To add each column, 6 + 8 is what, Sarah? To identify the next step, what do I do with my 1, James? To reinforce key terms, what's it called when I bring it to the top of the tens column, Jamar? And finally, to check the work. When your students answer incorrectly, you'll find yourself asking a student to correct and explain the mistake. Valerie says 6 ÷ 2 = 5. What did she do wrong, Ray? Your goal is to give them the most practice possible, to apply what they know as much as they can, to do all the work in solving sample problems as opposed to watching you solve sample problems. My own understanding of this complex technique was developed significantly by a conversation with Jesse Rector, principal of North Star Academy's Clinton Hill campus, who felt that one of my favorite ratio clips was disappointing. Rector observed that while students in the clip were participating actively, almost intensely, he did not think they were engaged in the deepest levels of thinking. His comments caused me to distinguish between what I'll call the thinking ratio and the participation ratio. The participation ratio describes how much of the participating, the answering, the talking, the writing, students do. Imagine a lesson in which students are reviewing a skill they are near to mastering or perhaps trying new and more challenging problems involving a process they're familiar with, say figuring the volume of a rectangular prism. Your goal is to give them the most practice possible, to apply what they know as much as they can, to do all the work in solving sample problems as opposed to watching you solve sample problems. You might ask questions like, "Who can tell me the first step?" and "What's my value for width?" "Great, and what do I do next?" "What do I need to be careful of?" "If my length increased by 1 and my width decreased by 1, would my volume stay the same?" These types of questions, which force students to apply and consolidate their knowledge, are important. but so are questions that ask students to push their depth of thinking and analyze new content. This would be more applicable when working through a problem on volume for the first time, or perhaps when wrestling with a question where the right answer is a matter of opinion. In this case, the questions might sound more like, why might I need to multiply? How is volume different from area? When might I measure volume? What would happen to my volume if my width increased? The thinking ratio gets more at the depth of the increased amounts of participating students do. A successful lesson is rarely marked by a teacher's getting a good intellectual workout at the front of the room. Push more and more of the cognitive work out to students as soon as they are ready, with the understanding that the cognitive work must be on task, focused, and productive. Champion teachers use dozens of methods in upping the ratio. It would be impossible to categorize them all, but what follows are 10 especially effective methods for productively upping your ratio. They are organized around the rough amount of lesson structure they imply. That is, the first methods are most effective during what you might call direct instruction, teacher-led dissemination of information. The latter methods are more likely to apply during discussions with more student participation. 1. Unbundle. Break questions into smaller parts to share the workout to more students and force them to react to one another. Instead of, who can tell me the three dimensions of a cylinder, try a sequence like this. How many dimensions to a cylinder, James? Good. What's one dimension, Shana? And what's another diamond? That leaves what, Terence? 2. Half statement. Rather than speaking in complete ideas, express half of an idea and ask a student to finish it. So the next step is to combine sentences with a, tell me please, John. 3. What's next? The fastest way to double the number of questions students get to answer is to ask about process as often as product. That is, addressing both how to solve a step, or what the answer to a step in a problem is, and what step comes next. Incidentally, the hardest what's next question is the one for the first step in any solution. Okay, what do I do first? 4. Feign ignorance. Turn the tables and pretend you don't know. Make the student play teacher and narrate what you might otherwise explain. So now, can I just add my numerators? A theme is just a summary of what happens in the story, right? 5. Repeated examples. Teachers often ask for examples of a term they're defining, a concept in action, a character's trait. They less often ask students for another example, especially one that's different from the first. This technique can be especially rigorous when you set the terms for how the second example should be different. Beth Verilli at North Star Academy asked her students to apply the word exploited to their reading of Macbeth. Who gets exploited in Macbeth? She asked, and followed up by asking for yet another example with a different character. A teacher in this situation might also steer the second example. Who gets exploited more subtly, repeatedly, with or without knowing it? 6. Rephrase or add on. Second drafts are better than first drafts because some of the most rigorous thinking goes into making ideas more precise, specific, and rich. Replicate this in the classroom by asking a student to rephrase and improve an answer she just gave, or by asking another student to revise or improve a peer's answer. In a lesson on Animal Farm, Rochester Prep principal and sometime reading teacher Stacy Shells asked a student why the rations due to all of the animals on Orwell's mythical farm were reduced except those of the pigs and the dogs. The student answered, "The pigs and the dogs' rations were not reduced because they were the higher standard of life. They were the ones being treated better." Her answer was solid, but weak in syntax and specificity of language. "You are correct," Shells responded, "but rephrase that." When the student struggled, Shells asked her peers, "Who can give her a word to use that will help her make her answer better?" And a peer suggested trying to use the word class. The student upgraded. "The pigs and the dogs were of a higher class than all the other animals, so their rations weren't reduced." 7. Whys and hows. Asking why or how instantly pushes more and more rigorous work onto students by forcing them to explain the thinking that solved or failed to solve the problem. 8. Supporting evidence. There's far more cognitive work to be done in supporting an opinion than in holding one, in testing its logic than in arguing for it. This process of stating an argument and supporting it involves extensive cognitive wrestling that can push your ratio higher. Ask your students constantly to explain how the evidence supports them, or give them a position or a variety of opinions and ask them to assemble evidence in support. 9. Batch process. As your students progress in the grades and into broader discussions, it's powerful for the teacher to strategically step out of the way at times and not comment on and validate every student comment, and instead allow a short series of student comments to be made directly following and ideally in response to one another. I've seen this described as playing volleyball rather than ping pong, but I prefer the term batch processing because it underscores that it's still your job to process and respond to student answers. They don't go unmediated by you. They just get discussed in smaller groups rather than singly. If you prefer the volleyball analogy, fine, but I'd offer 3 pieces of advice based on observing champion teachers. It's volleyball, not soccer. In volleyball, teammates pass the ball a limited number of times before returning the ball over the net. In the classroom, your students should, similarly, make finite group comments in a row as you continue to steer, respond, and process. They get the ball, then, after 2 or 3 hits, you get the ball. In soccer, by contrast, the goal of the players is to maintain possession constantly. That often means sacrificing movement toward the goal in order to keep the ball from the opposition for as long as possible. In the classroom, your students are not maintaining possession for as long as they want. Structure it so the ball is expected to pass back over to you at frequent and regular intervals. You may pass it back again, but you will do so having controlled the direction, pace, and focus of play to maximize productivity. If left unmanaged, students will often revert to soccer and take the ball in whatever direction best allows them to keep it, and that almost always means failure to get to the goal. Batch processing can be non-productive until students are mature and ready for it. If they are not intellectually prepared through years of study, they may go batting balls off in every direction. Be cautious with batch processing. Use it strategically, not as a default. Observation of champions suggests caution in using batch processing aggressively before high school. Teach habits of discussion first. Volleyball games work because everyone knows how to pass the ball and when it needs to go back over the net. They know this because they've been coached. The most effective teachers and schools I've seen do batch processing well intentionally teach habits of discussion, as my colleagues at North Star Academy in Newark call them. Basic procedures for how to interact. At North Star, teachers provide students with phrase starters to use in interacting. I agree with X because I want to say more about what you said. That's true because I understand what you're saying, but I have a different opinion. Point of view. What evidence can you give to support your opinion? 10. Discussion objectives. Open-ended questioning and broad discussions can seem like the ratio Rosetta Stone. They almost by their nature appear to increase ratio. But they can just as easily result in non-productive ratio, in students thinking or talking a lot but not thinking rigorously. People often confuse the amount of student participation for ratio, or in students thinking about peripheral or suboptimal topics. The goal is to try to focus discussions on the most productive and rigorous points. Teachers who do this have a clear objective in mind for any open-ended discussion and use hints to steer their students back on task and especially head off distractions and unproductive topics. Often they use the former to achieve the latter. That is, they share the objective for the discussion with students so they can remind them of their purpose when they stray. Emily Crouch, who teaches at Leadership Preparatory Charter School in Brooklyn, did this in a recent lesson. She read a story about a girl and advised her students that their goal in discussing the story was to determine which of several subtly different character traits provided the best description of her. This discussion was not only rigorous and evidence-based, but efficient. When a student suggested a totally different trait he thought was evidenced, she reminded him that their goal was to decide from among the similar traits they'd identified at the outset, thus keeping the discussion focused and productive. Before you set out to put these ideas into action in your classroom, I have two caveats. The first is that increased doses of cognitive work should come as soon as students are ready, but not before. Releasing students to solve a problem that requires a skill they hadn't learned or mastered yet, in the hopes that they might infer that skill by trying, would result in students doing a lot of thinking, but not a lot of productive thinking. I once observed a teacher who told her third graders to look through the book they were about to read to make inferences about what it was about. Alas, she had never taught them how to do that, so many flipped idly and at random through the pages, with most failing to take advantage of subtitles, chapter headings, and captions that might have informed them better. Any useful cognitive work they did was likely to be accidental. The second caveat is that increased doses of cognitive work should be given with constant and vigilant discipline in making that work focused and productive. You want students to do larger and larger shares of the right work. Theoretically, your ratio would be perfect if you simply let students run the whole discussion and just got out of the way. You might say, "Class, your task for today is to determine the most important historical figure in 19th century America. I expect you to discuss this question and report back to me in 1 hour." Or even better, "Class, here is a set of data about how a series of bodies in space react to one another. I'd like you to do your best to infer principles of gravitation from it. I will be here if you need me." Your ratio would be perfect, 100%, but your results would not. Your students would most assuredly not get to the right answer at all, and if they did, they would certainly not get there in the most efficient way. They would waste a massive amount of time and preclude themselves from studying any number of other topics. Technique 18. Check for understanding. Good drivers check their mirrors every 5 seconds. They constantly need to know what's happening around them because waiting for an accident to tell them they're doing something wrong is a costly strategy. As a teacher, you should think the same way, seeking constant opportunities to assess what your kids can do while you're teaching and using that knowledge to inform what you do and how you do it. Waiting until there's an accidental failure to comprehend means paying an unsustainably high price for knowledge. I've chosen to use a term in common use to describe this technique, check for understanding, but it's a risky one to use since it leaves the equation half done. The technique could more accurately be described as check for understanding and do something about it right away. That's not especially pithy, but it better captures the two key aspects of check for understanding, gathering and responding to data. Gathering data. Questioning is data gathering. Check for understanding requires you to think of the answers to your questions as data. Consider two teachers who ask their students to name a chief cause of the Civil War. In each case, three students answer incorrectly or incompletely before a fourth student gives an accurate answer. One teacher sees the answers as a story, a sequential narrative of the class's progress toward understanding that ends in success. She listens as her students wrestle with the question, and when she gets a correct answer, thinks, "Oh good, they finally got it." The other teacher sees not so much a story written in a sequence of answers, but a set of four independent variables, four separate data points. The narrative sequence is irrelevant, and the numbers cause her concern. She thinks, "Only one out of four kids understands the causes of the Civil War. I need to circle back." The second teacher treats